Good evening. This is Scotty Reed with a Black Talk Radio News Report. And joining me tonight is author John DeSantis, and he's the author of the book, The Thibodeau Massacre, which describes a massacre of Black, I would say, agricultural workers, but in their families as well. This did occur in Louisiana. Some of the things that we'll be talking about, for those who missed the interview that I did with Mr. DeSantis a while back, he will give us a brief history of what the Thibodeau Massacre entailed. And then we will talk about a fundraising campaign for those victims who stood up for their freedom. Right off the top, I want to tell you to visit www.la1887.org. That's www.la1887.org. There you can donate to the campaign to erect this monument. And we'll talk about some of the things that the campaign is for. Welcome back to Black Talk Radio, Mr. DeSantis.
Thanks so much. It's good to be back with you.
All right. Well, for those who may have missed that interview that I did with you, it was radio, and they may not have heard the podcast. Can you give them a brief historical synopsis of the Thibodeau Massacre, which occurred in Louisiana in 1887?
Absolutely. There was in 1887 in South Louisiana a strike of sugarcane workers. We're talking almost 25 years after the Civil War ended. We had been through Reconstruction, and the sugar plantations, and sugar was a huge crop in Louisiana, were going full tilt. They had recovered the sugar economy, more or less. And there were issues with how the people were paid and how much they were paid. Some of them were former slaves, and they didn't see a whole lot of difference between slavery and working as paid workers, or allegedly paid workers. So in November 1887, there was a strike. It stretched across three Louisiana parishes, and the state militia was called in. Ordered the striking workers off of the plantations where they were living, many in cabins that had been slave cabins prior to the war. And the people flocked to the town of Thibodeau. It's about 75 miles southwest of New Orleans. On November 23rd, 1887, it was the morning when the militia had gone back to New Orleans. There was a local militia, but there were a lot of people, a lot of white people, who were very upset at all of these people being in the town. On the morning of November 23rd, 1887, roughly after dawn, there was a incident involving some shots fired that hit two of the guards, civilian guards, who were keeping the town closed, keeping everybody from getting in or getting out. And when that happened, violence really began. That was when white mobs, some numbering 50 or 60 with guns, started banging on doors, ordering people out of houses as they encountered black people on the street, began to shoot them. The shooting went on for about 2.5 to 3 hours. And we don't know how many were killed. The estimates, the best estimates we've had to work with, tell us about between 30 and 60. We have recovered the names of 8 of the people who were killed. We only have 8 names, however. And nobody was ever brought to justice. There was never any investigation other than a very cursory coroner's inquest involving those bodies. And that is what happened in 1887.
And in terms of the media, again, you researched this, you've written a book, again, called The Thibodeau Massacre. In terms of the media coverage, if you came across any of the media newspapers, did they kind of participate in whitewashing the Thibodeau massacre?
Oh, they not only participated in whitewashing it, what they participated in doing was fomenting it in many instances. The local media was the main purveyors at that time of fear, tremendous fear. They actually went so far, one of the local newspapers ran a story that had run more than 10 years before, back during Reconstruction, when there were armed, authorized black militiamen on the streets of Thibodaux. Of course, the white folks didn't like that a whole lot. And they were very afraid of that. Well, a story about the history of that, in the midst of all of this fear, in the midst of the tension, the newspaper ran that story about that time, which, of course, led to more problems with the game of telephone. There were rumors that black folks had caches of weapons. This was not true. There were some individuals who did walk around with rifles for self-defense. We know that. We have no record that they used them on anybody. And there were no instances on that day of violence that we know of, other than those two that we mentioned that were wounded, of any white casualties.
And I think it's, I should point out, and I remember this from the last interview I did with you, there was no positive identification of who shot the two white guards.
No, there was never, no. And it what people said at the time was they must have, and these are their words, they must have been shot by Negroes. But there was no proof of that. That is the story that went out from that time, but there was never anybody convicted of it, and there was never any proof. And there was a lot of suspicion at the time, certainly among black people, that the people, the white people in the town of Thibodaux, might have done something themselves in order to bring about the violence, the mass violence that eventually occurred. That's correct, Scotty.
Yeah, that's a phrase we use today to describe that is victim blaming, you know, like how people will blame rape victims. And so, yeah, people will blame the victims of racism and terrorism. And like you just said, try to convince people that they must have done something to bring it upon themselves. Now, I do remember, I'm not sure if it's Jack Conrad, but our last interview, we talked about the federal government doing nothing to protect these U.S. citizens, and that the U.S. government, it was documented by the U.S. government because one of the surviving victims was a veteran, and I believe he went to a VA hospital or something, and his wounds were documented. Could you tell us that story again?
Yeah, he was actually treated by a physician in Thibodaux. Jack Conrad was born into slavery. He lived with a white family that ended up acquiring a sugar plantation. And he and his brother and his mom, we know, were slaves on this one plantation. Well, in 1863, the Union Army, which already had control, excuse me, in 1862, the Union Army, which already had control of New Orleans, came down the Bayou Country to Thibodaux, and there was a battle a little north of Thibodaux. They came in. When they came in, they occupied the town, and Jack Conrad, who had been a slave, and a number of other men, joined the United States Army, the Federal Army, Lincoln's Army, at that point. Now, Jack, we know from his records, he stayed with the 75th U.S. Colored Infantry all the way through the end of the war. He was at the Battle of Port Hudson. He was part of the Red River campaign. And he mustered out at New Orleans. He came to back to Thibodeau, went back to live with the family that, he had worked for prior to emancipation. So he went back to that plantation. He got married. He and his wife had children, three children. One we've lost count of, but we definitely know about two. And Jack ended up becoming a mechanic working on a plantation, which meant he didn't have to stay on the plantation anymore. He was able to move his family to, excuse me, to a rent house in Thibodeau. In 1890, this would have been 3 years after the Thibodeau Massacre, Congress changed the law, and they said if you were a United States Army veteran from that war, and if you couldn't work because of some injury, even if the injury was suffered after the war, that you could file for a pension. It was a small pension, modest pension, but you could file for it. Jack Conrad filed for what they called an invalid pension, and they needed to know what happened. He was able to provide his medical records. They were placed in the file. And he was able to get affidavits, sworn statements from various witnesses who saw what happened and who saw what happened to him. What happened to him was Jack was roused from sleep. He was home actually sick that day. And there were 50 or 60 armed white men outside. They ordered him outside the house. The other men in the house were ordered out. He watched his 19-year-old son, Grant Conrad, get shot down. He watched Marcel Weldon, who was another relative, get shot down. Jack had been shot. He crawled under his house to try to escape the gunfire. The assailant presumed he was dead, and they moved on to a house further down the block. So what we have with this file that is in the National Archives, we were able to piece together the first account from black people of what happened that day. Up till now has been the victim blaming and the nobody talking and people saying, nah, that never happened. We have the proof. We have it in the sworn statements. And there is absolutely no mistaking what went on that day.
Right. Now, I want to transition to the campaign that you, Mr. Conrad's descendants and others, you have created this website to help raise funds, what's called a recovery project. And again, that's at www.la1887.org. And let's talk about some of the things that these funds will be used for. Number one is the remains, because you mentioned earlier in the interview that we don't know exactly how many victims may be lying in a unmarked mass grave.
I'm sorry, Scotty, go ahead.
No, I was saying, could you tell us about the work that needs to be done in locating remains of victims?
Absolutely. We know from oral history that's been handed down in the predominantly black part of Thibodeau that there is some land. It's private land. It now belongs to an American Legion Hall. It's land on which they have their crawfish boils, and they use it kind of as a semi-parking lot and so on. That the remains of people who were killed in the Thibodeau Massacre were placed in a mass grave on that site. Is there documentation of it? No, because they didn't want to document it for anybody. But we know after talking with some of the elders in Thibodeau who they were told this. And this has, gone on from generation to generation. And a memorial to these people. But first, we would like to do the proper thing and make sure that we know that they are there. And so we submitted what we had to the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. They have a public archaeology lab. And they have done a formal proposal to use various scientific devices, various technology that they have, and they will determine whether there is evidence of human remains at that site, and if there is, whether there is enough evidence to move forward, which then brings us to phase two.
Right. Now, phase two would be if you are able to locate the remains of the victims, why is it important to do a forensic examination and identification? Is that to further provide evidence of how they died or were killed?
Yes, and there would be several reasons for that. Number one, it was what the clergymen in Thibodaux, such as the pastor of the AME Church, which is located not far from this site, immediately said they wanted. They wanted to know if there was going to be a way of identifying the people once they were removed. One of the things that the committee did, we went to the clergy and we said, you know, we have family members who say they'd like them if they're found to be removed. Are you okay with that? Because these could be many people from many people's families. And the clergyman resoundingly said, yes, they were put there by people who killed them. We don't want them there. We want them in sacred ground. Well, because of the peculiarities and the requirements of the forensic science, they're going to have to do forensic examination probably to figure out who's who. And in addition to that, one of the things that we've talked about is trying to get cooperation from Ancestry DNA. They've done this with some other projects before. They're doing it with the Georgetown Slaves Project right now. And that would be to take DNA from the remains and start a DNA bank so that relatives, people who are descended from some of these victims, people who were related to them, would be able to claim their descendancy and know if someone related to them was one of the victims in this horrible attack. So that's one reason. The other thing is, from a medico-legal standpoint, there is a lot we can learn about it. Because what we have here, if indeed we find remains, what we've got is a 130-year-old crime scene.
Right.
Although that is something, I mean, I've talked to the district attorney about it. He's very supports the project. And what I asked him was, I said, well, Mr. Morvan, are we looking at a crime scene or an archaeological site? And he said, well, yes, it would be a crime scene. Yeah, absolutely. He said, however, there is no one that I can prosecute for this now. So, I mean, I can't do anything about it. But everything that we can learn, artifacts that may be with the people, including bullets, including, you know, what killed them and so on. So I think there is a lot to be learned forensically. And I think as we would do today with any other murder, and this is a mass murder, it is important if we can get the work done to know everything that we can about what happened that day, because nobody else is talking.
Now, in some information you sent me earlier about where they possibly might be located, you mentioned that, and of course we've mentioned that this was a mass grave, you know, probably bodies just thrown on top of each other. These were not regular burials. And you wrote that they were dumped in a place where mules were buried by their killers and a city dump was created on top of them. Can you clarify that for me?
Yes. One of the what's happened since the book, The Thibodaux Massacre, has been released, people, especially black people, especially older black people in Thibodaux, are starting to talk. And they're telling us many of the things that they were told by their grandparents. And one of the things that I was told, there was an elder gentleman who was in a barber shop right near the site. And he said, I want to tell you something. He said, you have a hard time with that site. We're trying to find the people. I said, why is that? He said, that's the place where they used to bury the mules. And he didn't know a lot about it. But we started checking that with some other folks in the community. And, yes, that had been a site that was used for the burial of mules. At some point, that lot or a portion of it was used as a dump by the city. We don't have an exact year on that. However, in talking with Dr. Mark Reese from ULL, who's going to be heading up the scientific team, he said if that is the case, that may actually make the job easier in terms of location and identification. I would not have thought that, but I'm not the archaeologist. And he says that can help a great deal because it would give a linear sense of how the, you know, soil was disturbed during what periods and by what. So we're very optimistic that if there are people there, that we're going to be able to locate them. And once they go to ULL, that's phase two, then we will have phase three. Phase three is that individuals will be returned to Thibodaux. They will receive solemn remembrance. And I'm hoping, quite frankly, that everybody in town turns out and comes and prays to these folks. And I would like to see it done in the big civic auditorium, which is a wonderful place for such an event. And if people in Thibodaux are smart, they will be able to do something that will have their town known, not just for this horrendous atrocity, but for the willingness and the fortitude in the 21st century to be people of goodwill and to make it right.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go right ahead, Scotty.
Well, over the past couple of days, I have been examining the Confederate monument issue that has been, you know, coming up. It started back when Dylann Roof murdered those people in South Carolina in the Emmanuel Historic African Church. We then had a woman by the name of Bree Newsom from North Carolina climb the flagpole at the Capitol in South Carolina to remove the Confederate flag. Now, Condoleezza Rice a few days ago on Fox News and Friends was saying, hey, we don't need to remove these monuments to slavers and terrorists and white supremacists. We need those so we know our history. And, you know, what came to my mind, Mr. DeSantis is, well, do Jews need statues and monuments to Hitler and Nazis in order to remember that history? I said more appropriately would be a monument, and I'm saying to myself, more appropriate would be these sort of monuments, which the recovery project and the campaign you are involved in, along with the descendants of the victims, that would be a more appropriate monument if we want to remember history. You have any thoughts on that?
I agree, and I think that, you know, we've had, of course, the monument issue in New Orleans, which is still ongoing. Two monuments have been removed so far. And those monuments, this is one of the situations involving the two separate conversations that occur, white people and black people. And white people look and say, oh, there's, you know, a guy on a horse, and it was the Civil War, and it was a long time ago. Black families have handed down from family to family that what is there is a statue that was put up a little shortly after the time of things like the Thibodaux Massacre to honor what these people called the Lost Cause. And I will be honest, I have mixed views. I, on the one hand, I fully understand the reason the city council wants them taken down. And guess what? They belong to the city council. So if New Orleans feels that, those statues don't, you know, make the kind of statement that they want made, then they should come down. I have seen places where there have been things added to Confederate monuments or placed beside them, which either give an alternative honoring to some folks, or give more of a 360 kind of a story of what occurred. Now, I will tell you this. I will tell you that I have been nowhere in South Louisiana, and I've been all over South Louisiana for many years now. I have yet to see a statue that honors the people who broke their backs loading sugarcane. Big, you know, things, big stalks of cane. People who died. People who, when slavery ended, still lived as slaves. There's not a monument. The closest we have to any monument to those people, and thank goodness, is at the Whitney Museum, which has won awards and won great recognition because it tells the story of the enslaved people in a very good way, in a very special way, in a very sensitive way.
Right.
But these people who worked in sugar, there is no monument to them. There is no monument to their labor. And yet, the people who are the descendants of some of these people that we know about that died, some of them ended up staying in sugar. You know, that's what they did. So I think two things that are going to be very appropriate if we are successful with this project. And one is that the dead will be casketed and will be buried in sacred ground, number one. That's the most important thing. And number two, that there be some sort of a monument to the victims of this horrific atrocity. And that is something that I think in time we can have. Of course, we're doing it a step at a time right now. We're just trying to get the 25 grand that ULL says they'll need to start turning shovels. And that's our first phase.
Could you repeat that? What is the amount that you hope to raise? Again, viewers and listeners, you can go to www.la1887.org if you would please like to make a contribution. But what is the target amount that the project is trying to raise to complete this work?
ULL has said in their estimate to us that in order to do the most effective job and use certain types of tools that we would like them to use, that it's going to cost around $25,000. That phase of it, that discovery phase. That's going to involve radiological materials. That's, you know, radar. That's going to involve some turning of dirt. That's going to involve some core sampling. And it's going to involve ULL personnel being there at the scene and doing the work.
Well, I would just like to say we have about 18,000 followers on Facebook, another 8 or 10,000 on Twitter. We have about 30,000 visitors a month to our platform, blacktalkradionetwork.com. So it is my hope that all those individuals who tune in, who consume the media that we produce, will at least make a donation of a couple of dollars, because then you could, that would be the 25,000 you need right there.
Yeah, that's a great entreaty, Mr. Reed. And I will mention that, yes, descendants of Jack Conrad are on the advisory board. We have a multiracial advisory board, and we are a Louisiana corporation, nonprofit, Nobody takes any salaries for any of this. And we're hoping that we'll be able to raise the debt.
Well, Mr. DeSantis, I want to thank you for documenting this history. Again, the name of the book is The Thibodeau Massacre. Would you like to leave our listeners and viewers with final comments?
Certainly. You know, when I wrote the book, The Thibodeau Massacre, there were people who said, why do you want to rehash all that? Well, why do you want that? And my answer to them was, because it's never really been hashed to begin with. The story was never really told. Now we are at a stage where we have the potential to do justice to these people, not in the same way as maybe, you know, it should have been done back then, but we have the potential of letting them go home, letting them be placed away for their dismissal by people who care about who they were. And I can tell you that I can't think now that that book is done of anything better for me to be involved with. And we're hoping that people on a grassroots level will help us to lay these people to rest.
Well, Mr. DeSantis, thank you for speaking with Black Talk Radio News. You have a good evening, sir.
You too, Mr. Reed.